We begin in Iraq today, where several days of U.S. airstrikes have helped Kurdish forces retake some territory from the radical militant group ISIS. Senior U.S. officials have confirmed that American forces are providing weapons to Kurdish forces, helping that group defend Erbil, the capital of the Iraqi Kurdistan region. Meanwhile, Iraq's embattled Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki said he would not step down in Baghdad and has called for another term. A parliament session scheduled to take place today to choose government leaders has now been postponed. For more on the situation with ISIS and in Iraq, we're joined now by Daniel Benjamin, director of the Dickey Center for International Understanding at Dartmouth College, a former coordinator for counterterrorism at the State Department from 2009 until 2012. Ambassador Benjamin, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you. Ambassador, people have been shocked by the brazenness and horror of ISIS. ISIS has YouTube videos and tweets putting their horrific campaign on display. This is clearly no accident. This is strategy.
Oh, it's absolutely strategy. ISIS is determined to present itself as the global leader of the jihadi cause. And by putting all this material on the web, it is reinforcing its claim in that regard. It is beckoning, if you will, to potential recruits. And it is also staking a claim for what kind of group it is and saying it's quite different from al-Qaeda, that it's holding territory, that it's actually on the roll, that it's winning. It's a very, very different kind of operation than we have seen for some years.
And you've made the point, in fact, that they've distinguished themselves from al-Qaeda, a group that they view as too timid, as strange as that sounds.
Well, this goes back to the origins of al-Qaeda in Iraq, which is the antecedent of ISIS. And al-Qaeda in Iraq was the franchise of al-Qaeda, but it was a very independent franchise from the beginning, led by Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. It set its goals as being quite different from al-Qaeda's. Above all, it wanted to sow a real sectarian conflict, and it wanted to kill as many Shia as possible, and it wanted to tear apart Iraq, which it thought would create the opening to create this much-discussed caliphate. And Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the current leader, is very much pursuing the same strategy. His forces have been strengthened by their engagement in Syria, and they're using that strength to pursue their goals.
Meanwhile, as we look toward Baghdad, Ambassador Benjamin, I just mentioned the political confrontation going on there between Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, the president of Iraq, Sunni and Shia factions within the government, failure to form a new government. Can you help us understand a little bit how that failure in Baghdad is emboldening ISIS, how it helps them?
Well, paralysis on the part of your enemy is always to your advantage. So ISIS, I'm sure, is enjoying this a great deal. From their perspective, it's different varieties of Shia chauvinism on display in Baghdad. And al-Maliki is digging in. He's got deployed troops that are loyal to him around Baghdad. And the possibility that there will be a conflict within Baghdad itself, you know, is just music to the ears of ISIS. And as long as Baghdad can't move beyond where it is now, can't move beyond a narrow sectarian agenda and the Maliki vision of Iraq, then ISIS is in a very good position indeed. And they're probably also recognizing that as long as that continues, the likelihood of outside intervention, particularly from the United States, is diminished, because I think President Obama understands that as long as that disease persists in Baghdad, then there's no reason to treat the symptoms elsewhere in the country.
Well, it's outside intervention that I want to talk to you about directly, because, you know, I think most Americans probably understand why U.S. troops are not going back on the ground in Iraq. People understand that, and I think Americans wouldn't support it, of course. But why right now, as ISIS advances across Iraq and displays this horrific campaign of theirs, why are there not 100 or 200 Predator drones in the skies over Iraq hitting ISIS wherever they see them? Not U.S. troops on the ground, but remote drones hitting ISIS that way. Why are we not doing that?
Well, they're operational reasons, and then there are strategic reasons. And operationally, I'm not sure that we have all the information we want to carry out those attacks yet, although I am sure we can in the near future. But strategically, I think it's what I alluded to before. The United States doesn't have any interest in fighting Nouri al-Maliki's wars if his sectarianism is driving the radicalization that afflicts Iraq and that is tearing the country apart. We want very much to see a new day in Baghdad, a new government that is inclusive, that attends to the concerns of all the communities within Iraq. I think the administration still wants to see a unitary state, and we're not going to get that as long as the political deadlock persists in Baghdad and that Maliki remains at the helm. So that's really a precondition for a more robust engagement. Right now, if we take lots of shots at ISIS, then we just encourage that free rider mentality
and risk inflaming
in Baghdad.
And risk inflaming the situation, certainly. Ambassador Daniel Benjamin, former coordinator for counterterrorism at the State Department, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
We go now to the city of Erbil in northern Iraq, the capital of the country's Kurdish region. It's become a place of refuge for thousands of Iraq's religious minorities. The city is also a stronghold for the U.S. military. It's home to a consulate and about 800 U.S. military personnel. Well, just yesterday, in an op-ed in the Washington Post, Masoud Barzani, the president of the Kurdish region of Iraq, pleaded for U.S. help. He said, "We are the United States' staunch allies in the region, and we have the only force in the area with the means and the will to protect thousands of lives from the horrors these terrorists bring. But we cannot do it alone." Of course, these terrorists, he's referring to ISIS. And listen to John McCain on CNN yesterday.
"I would be rushing equipment to Erbil. I would be launching airstrikes not only in Iraq but in Syria against ISIS. I would be providing as much training and equipment as I can to the Kurds. And I would do a lot of things that we can not have to wait for Maliki to leave."
John McCain there. Well, retired Colonel Harry Shute is now an advisor to the Kurdistan regional government. He commanded a U.S. Civil Affairs battalion in Iraq in 2003 and led the U.S. Army Command in Kurdistan during the early phases of the war. Welcome, Colonel Shute.
Thank you.
Colonel, there's been limited bombing, of course, on the outskirts of Erbil and also near Mount Sinjar. We've read about that. We've also read that this has emboldened the Peshmerga, the Kurdish security forces. Can you describe how they're emboldened and what that means?
Well, the airstrikes that the U.S. government has performed have provided a huge morale boost to the Kurdish Peshmerga. They were feeling kind of all alone. And those airstrikes have given them a sense that there is someone with them, somebody supporting them. And so not only the Peshmerga, but the people in Kurdistan, there's almost a huge sigh of relief that the support has started to come.
I just read part of an impassioned plea from the president of the Kurdish region there. He's asking for U.S. support. He's asking for U.S. heavy weapons, not just moral support, but making the point that the Peshmerga need to be able to match ISIS forces and push them back. What would heavier weapons mean? What can the U.S. do militarily there?
Well, heavy weapons literally can mean anything from large caliber machine guns, rockets, to anti-tank weapons, to armored vehicles, literally everything. And the reason for that is because the Peshmerga, the Kurdish forces, are simply armed with weapons that they captured from Saddam Hussein from 2003 and earlier. So everything they have is very old, it's obsolete, poor condition, whereas ISIS is armed with equipment that they took from the Iraqi army when they collapsed 2 months ago, which is mostly equipment that was provided to them by the U.S. government.
Now, is it as simple, however, Colonel Shute, of just giving the Kurds lots of heavy weapons? I mean, there is a political ecosystem in Iraq that is extremely complicated, more complicated even than before in the last couple of days in Baghdad. Would the Baghdad central government stand for a heavily armed Kurdish region? For that matter, would Turkey stand for it? Can we just airdrop lots of heavy weapons, artillery, tanks, and give it to the Kurds?
Well, certainly it is a complex mix. In fact, one of the reasons why the Peshmerga have not been armed until now is because of obstruction from Baghdad. But of course, as you mentioned, we are in the middle of a very dynamic and changing scenario in Baghdad as we speak. But the reality is that the Peshmerga are the one viable force who is standing up in Iraq to fight against ISIS. And we know who they are. They have been very loyal, very supportive of us. I mean, I can say as a commander who was here commanding troops in 2003, 2004, the fact that I was able to bring every one of my soldiers out of Iraq unharmed is a testament to the capabilities of the Peshmerga. There are not many places in the country where my colleagues can say the same thing.
Colonel Shute, I want to ask you the same question I asked Daniel Benjamin a couple of minutes ago. Everybody understands why there won't be U.S. troops back on the ground in Iraq. I think we all get that. But why are there not 100 Predator drones over the skies of northern Iraq now hitting ISIS wherever we see them?
Well, that's a very good question. Perhaps somebody in Washington may know the answer to that. I know our friends here in Kurdistan would welcome that. They have the facilities to support it. And believe me that those Predators would have plenty of work to do.
I want to move on to the humanitarian situation for a moment. There are, of course, thousands, tens of thousands of Yazidi people stranded on Mount Sinjar. Some have escaped into Syria. Many thousands more remain on the mountain. Also, many refugees in your region there in Erbil. Can you give a sense of the humanitarian situation, the refugee situation, as people flee ISIS there?
Well, that's a very desperate situation as well. Just in the Kurdistan region alone, there are 1.2 million refugees and displaced people. Some of the people that have come down off of Mount Sinjar have been able to make it with Peshmerga assistance up into the city of Duhok. And as you mentioned, some have gone into Syria. But we're in a situation here where the Baghdad government has withheld the budget from the Kurdistan regional government since the beginning of the year. So it's challenging enough for the Kurdistan regional government to pay for their own activities, let alone support a population of 1.2 million additional people who are in a desperate situation with no shelter, limited food. It's a great challenge and something that I think the international community really needs to step up to soon.
Harry Shute's a retired U.S. colonel and an advisor now to the Kurdistan regional government. He led a U.S. Army command in Kurdistan during the early phases of the war there in 2003. Colonel, thank you.
You're welcome.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.